Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody out there. Hope you're all doing super well in this quarantine lockdown pandemic universe. Welcome to another episode of Broadway Breakdown, My Obsession. I am your co-host, Matt Koplik, basically your host these days. John Miscavige will return shortly. But anywho, enough about that gay. I have another gay with me to talk about his obsession. He's a comedian. He's a podcaster. You know him from Instagram. You know him from iTunes. From his podcast Slumber Party, and just, you know, all the numerous, I don't want to call them Vines because Vine doesn't exist anymore, but Vine-like content all over the social medias. Mr. Tim Murray. Hello, Tim.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I knew of you for a while, and then when Miss Melanie Brooke, deep friend of the pod, Melanie Brooke came on to do an episode, she was like, you should have Tim Murray on to do an obsession. I was like, oh, that would be grand.
Oh my gosh, she's the best. That's my girl. And you know, one of my most popular videos is because of Miss Melanie Brooke.
Yeah.
I did this We Get It, You Know Each Other video, and she was so, so funny.
She was very funny. You actually had a couple of people in your videos that have been on this pod. You did, you used to do, like, I don't want to call them music videos. They were musicals. They were like 3-minute musicals. Where you musicalized fights or moments from Drag Race's Untucked series, and you would bring people on with you. So you had Josh Daniel, you had Cray Henson, who've both been on the pod as well. Very, very funny shit.
My faves. Yes. Love those boys. And I have to shout out.
Oh, that sorry. One second. The phone is ringing. Fuck the outside world. All right, now give a shout out.
I was going to shout out Henry Kopersky, my dear friend who's had the idea for Untucked Musical. He mm-hmm. called me and was like, there's something about the way that Pheromone just talked.
Damn it. All right, dude, keep talking. I'm going to unplug this motherfucker.
Okay. He was like, there's something about the way Pheromone was talking to Kimora Black and vice versa in this recent Untucked. And I just wanted, it just struck me as so funny and I want to figure out what to do with it. And he had the idea to musicalize it. And then once he wrote the song, I came in and sang it and we had so much fun doing it and it was so ridiculous. And then we were like, okay, let's not stop doing this. So then we started making more of them and we made Untucked the Musical with like a bunch of videos from that season with Larry Owens and Bowen Yang and Matt Rogers and all these really fun
the
people
gays.
And Gray and Josh, the gays.
You know, the gays. Also, you were, this is so like inside baseball and you might consider me stalkery for knowing this, but you had done a Michael Henry video as well that I'm obsessed with.
Which I love Michael Henry. Which one?
Were you in more than one?
Well, he's been in some of mine. I've been in some of his, I think.
Yes.
But maybe, oh, the one with Johnny Sibley?
Maybe it's the one where you don't have any lines until the very, very end. It's the, he's talks about how he doesn't want to be a sex object anymore. You're on the stoop. Do you know what I'm talking
about?
Oh,
Yeah.
And then the one line you have at the end is that he was farting the entire time. I'm assuming that wasn't in the script. That was just true while you were filming.
Yeah. Just, that, yeah. I was like, were you passing gas this whole time? We're good buddies just from making videos together. I reached out to him years ago on like Facebook and was like, hey, I love your videos. And he said the same to me. And then I moved out to LA and we actually live in the same block now. So we are quarantine buddies. He is one of the only people I'm seeing other than my roommate. And we go on social distance walks. I saw him last night, actually. He's so funny and so great.
Yes, he is very funny, very great. I enjoy many of his videos. So you are based in LA now, correct?
I am, yeah. I moved to LA 2 years ago.
But you started off as a New York actor. From what I understand. Yes. And yeah, then you said, fuck this noise. I'm moving west and I'm going to be a comedian.
Yeah, I said, enough of this. Yeah, it all kind of happened at once. It was pretty crazy. I was in the 50 Shades musical off Broadway with Melanie for like a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then when that ended, I found that to be like very devastating. Mm-hmm. And I sort of, I don't know, I just thought, I was like, well, I'm paying for my rent in New York City as an actor. This is what life is now. And then it wasn't after that. So I was like, oh God, I have to keep reinventing myself. So I had the opportunity to move out to LA. And when I came here, I started doing stand-up. And now I do comedy mostly. It's great.
Yeah. It's a lot of great content. And then the Slumber Party podcast, how did that come about?
So my friend Peter Kim and I were sitting around and we were like, we're funny. Why don't we have a podcast? And so I had already done a YouTube series called Slumber Party, like an interview talk show type thing with Michael Henry and Johnny Sibley and John Wan and a couple great New York City comedy people. And then, so we had this idea to interview LGBTQ people about their sleepover experiences growing up and how the things they had to hide about that and do like an adult redo. And now it's still going, but now I'm doing it just by myself. No Peter anymore. Yeah.
Is there drama there? Like, was there a big fallout? Was it he wanted to be Daisy? He wanted to be Violet? Like,
exactly. Mad drama. Is one better than the other, Daisy or Violet?
Oh, absolutely not. That's a sideshow reference, everybody, for those who don't know.
You wanted to be Lucy and I wanted to be Lucy, but neither of us would be the Emma. No, he he has another
podcast. Jekyll and Hyde, everybody, by the way.
Yeah, Jekyll and Hyde, everybody.
Nothing wrong with Emma, by the way. Kelly O'Hara was once an Emma.
Was she really?
Yeah, on tour, and then she understudied on the Broadway.
Okay. Love that information that I didn't know.
You know that she's interrupt you again, but you know that she's in the video with David Hasselhoff, right? Kelly O'Hara.
I have that. Where is she?
She's in the ensemble. I think she has two solos. The only one that's coming to me right now is in the Murder at the opening of Act Two. She has "He'll Kill at Will," and it's just like not. It doesn't fit properly in her voice. And you know she knows because she's like trying to give it this like kind of anger while like belting a note she doesn't really have.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it's just so fun. Like it's not in the like, cynical kind of way. It's just sometimes nice to see people who you love so much, you've just seen be perfect so many times. Yeah, it's like,
yeah,
even Kelly O'Hara sometimes couldn't negotiate a note. And like, it's fine. It's totally fine.
Yeah, because she is, I mean, truly, every time I see her, I'm like, I already thought you were perfect, and now somehow you've gotten better. She's really damn good.
Yeah, sometimes it's annoying. Anyway, Peter, no drama. He wanted to cut you loose now.
Yeah, he has another podcast that he does on top of Slumber Party, and honestly in this crazy quarantine time, he's like, I don't know if you feel like this, but I feel like a lot of stuff is becoming Zoom calls. And he was like, this was really fun when we got to physically get together, but I don't want to do two Zoom calls for two different podcasts every single week.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I understand that, but I'm still doing it.
Yeah, go girl. I mean we're doing Zoom right now, so I totally get it. And I mean, I don't know.
I'm down for the Zoom calls. He just wasn't down for the Zoom calls.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with it. I'm actually gonna start I'm not personally starting it. I am participating in a second podcast pretty soon. So there's a chance that I might be like Peter and just be like, no, I can't. I need human interaction. I need to spend my time more wisely. But until that moment comes, I'm gonna spread myself thinner than those girls on the bikes in the search for Eldwoods.
I love this transition you just gave us. What a transition.
So this, there's no time like the present. Let's just move right along into Mr. Tim Murray's obsession. What is your obsession today, Tim?
The MTV reality show from 2008, I believe, called Legally Blonde, The Search for Elle Woods, hosted by none other than Hailey Duff herself.
Broadway superstar Hailey Duff.
Broadway superstar who had been in over zero shows. She was in Hairspray, and then she starts talking to these girls like, she's like, well, these people got me ready for Broadway. And since I am a Broadway veteran, let me tell you how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, literal future Tony winner Lena Hall is on stage, already having four Broadway shows under her belt, just kind of like, okay, Hailey Duff.
Yeah.
That's tell me what it's like to do eight shows a week for your whole career.
Yeah. So it's going to be really hard not to like go off on tangents, A, because this podcast goes on tangents all the time, but because like, so... there's just so much to talk about. So I feel like one thing is going to lead into another thing. So we just have, you just have to remind me sometimes, like, Matt, we were talking about this 5 minutes ago. We need to come back to this subject. So I'm assuming you got into the series when the rest of us did in 2008, when it aired. Had you seen Legally Blonde on Broadway by that point?
Okay. So here is, am I going to tell this story?
Yes, you are.
I saw Legally Blonde when I was 19. I think it was like a freshman or sophomore in college. I came to the city. I got student rush ticket. I was in the front row. And, okay, everyone can be mad at me for this all you want, but I was dumb at 19 and I didn't know any better. And this is aging me. This is pre-YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
This is pre, like, Legally Blonde came out right when YouTube was, like, launching. So, yeah. Or it had been out maybe a little bit, but, like,
YouTube was not like a place to put bootlegs or like create content.
It was like
very new.
You know, he kicked him in the penis. It hurt.
Yeah, it was very bad. Charlie, like, bit my finger.
It was very that. It was not like, I remember going to New York City being so excited to see like Brooklyn the Musical and Little Women, because the only places you could see even small clips of those videos was on Broadway.com. Like, mm-hmm. Imagine not being able to watch any of Astonishing. How sad is that for your life? And I would look and none of that stuff was on there. And I loved this so much. I just wanted to capture, I wasn't going to post it anywhere. I just wanted to capture part of it to take with me to watch on the plane again and watch when I was back in Ohio or in college, right? Mm-hmm. So I took my digital camera out during like, three different numbers, and I tried to videotape three different numbers. Yeah, I was fully breaking the rules.
Yeah.
And as I was doing that, Leslie Kritzer saw me from the stage, and she lifted her sunglasses up from her, like, whatever that scene is, where they're, like, dancing, the three muses are dancing together, the three Greek chorus,
mm-hmm.
and she marched to the, like, a little bit out of her formation and looked me right in the eyes, and she mouthed to me, "Turn the fucking camera off." And so I did. And I mouthed back, "I'm so sorry." And then I like kept the camera away, obviously, the rest of the time. And then after the curtain came down, I like ran out of there because I was so worried they were going to steal my camera from me. But yeah, that I was 19. I learned my lesson. I never did it.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair to you, it's not like you were the first person to film that show. As we know, there are videos abound of that show. You were just young and dumb and didn't know how to hide it. That's all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they were all like, girl, MTV is coming in here next week to film this whole thing. You can just watch it on your television.
That is also very true.
You don't need to be bootlegging.
So you watched it on MTV as well then?
Oh, yeah. I saw it then, and then I watched when they aired the live version on MTV with my friends in college, and then I watched The Search for Elle Woods reality show, obviously, because I was obsessed.
Yes. Did you get to see the show once the winner was announced, or were you not able to?
I only saw it that one time.
Okay. And so, after the show finished, and things happened with Legally Blonde, you know, what have you, did you come back to it frequently, or was it sort of like a long period and then all of a sudden you kind of rediscovered it?
I had watched it in real time, and then in, when was Nerds going to come to Broadway? 2014, 13?
That sounds about right. Yeah, 14, 15.
Somewhere around there, I was living with my roommate, Pierce Cassidy, who has been in Book of Mormon. He was like on the tour as the tap dancing one, and he's been on the Something Rotten tour. Mm-hmm. And but on tour, never Broadway. And he was, at the time, and he was going to make his Broadway debut in Nerds. Mm. And we were living together, and he, you know, came home one day and was like, they, you know, told us in rehearsal as we were preparing to make my Broadway debut that we're not doing the show anymore. It's not happening. And he might have moved in like right after he found out about that, but it was right around that time. He was just so, I loved him so, I'd still love him so much. He's like such a fun, wonderful guy, and he worked so hard, and he was so bummed. And I was like, I just want you to feel good right now, and I want you to restore your faith in theater. So we sat down, and when it was only the first episode was on YouTube back then, like 2014, 15, and we rewatched it together then. And I just remember both of us like scream laughing and being like, I can't believe this is real.
Mm-hmm.
And then during quarantine, I saw my buddy Drew Anderson tweet that the whole thing is on YouTube right now. And I was like, that's what I should rewatch right now. And I, as I started rewatching, I started videotaping myself watching it mm-hmm. from my Instagram stories. And I've never gotten the kind of response I got from that. Every day I would wake up to like 30 to 50 DMs, which is obviously very unusual, of people being like, oh my God, I forgot about this show. Or like, what even is happening? Or, mm-hmm. you know, Justice for Autumn, whatever
Justice
people are saying.
For Autumn. I feel that.
Yeah, so then I became even more obsessed as I was rewatching and reposting, and then I was like, okay, I need to if there's anything that would bring me pure joy in this world, it would be to reunite these girls and do a Zoom reunion with them.
Yes, so Tim did a Zoom reunion with the entire, I think it was top 15 that went down to the top 10 like after like 30 minutes into the Zoom. Yeah,
correct.
Top 15 contestants for Legally Blonde, The Search for Elle Woods. Plus, you also had the show's three judges, book writer Heather Hawk. Is that how you say her name?
Heather Hawk? I think so.
Let's say Heather Hawk. Casting nobody, Bernie Telsey. And, and then cast member Paul Kanan. And then the producer, Amanda Lipitz.
Yeah.
Yes. And then you had a co-host on the Zoom, correct? Jen
Sandler, yeah, who works at 54 Below. Yeah.
Got it. Because they had done a reunion concert as well.
Yeah. So the way it went down is I tweeted, I really want to get these girls reunited. I messaged them all on Instagram. They mm-hmm. weren't responding for the first several hours. And then Jen messaged me and she was like, hey, we just did a reunion concert with some of them like 2 years ago. I have all their emails. If you let me co-host with you, I will email all of them. And I don't think this is any big secret, but they were all a little bit trepidatious about ever revisiting this whole topic because it was mm-hmm. kind of traumatizing for a lot of them, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
And so Jen was like, I think they'll feel safer to do this if I do it with you. And I was like, mm-hmm. okay.
So I watched it last night. I don't want to say all of it. I watched most of it, but that's because I was doing research yesterday. I watched the entire series last night, yesterday, like as a rebuff of our episode today. I was like, I'll watch some of the Zoom. Like, I want to get an idea of sort of what Tim did, thinking I would watch like 10 to 15 minutes of this 2.5 hour Zoom reunion. I got an hour and a half into it and then had to stop because I was like, I need Tim to give me some surprises from this thing. Like, I can't just sit there and be like, oh yeah, I remember when Autumn said that or when Bailey said that. I want you to be able to bring something to the table. But I thought it was actually very well structured that way because by having the creatives there for the first like 45 minutes and the other five girls, it sort of had a nice communal feeling. It let everybody sort of ease into it. It was sweet. Everyone was remembering. Everyone was complimenting. And so when they left, the 10 remaining girls were a lot more relaxed and then able to just sort of relate to each other, which I thought was really fantastic.
Yeah, because I think that's the cool thing. I think that's why we all love the show. I mean, it was very cool to see here with the Amanda Lipitz, who created it, how she decided to do this. And it was such a smart, like, marketing thing. And it's cool to hear from Bernie Telsey and just hear, like, you know, where his head was at, going from being the top casting director in the city to now being like, I mean, for a little while, a reality TV personality. Like that, that was all very fascinating. But then it was really nice to just make it more about like why I was interested in this from the beginning, which is like, there's never ever been a show like this. Like anytime there, even Grease, You're the One That I Want, which is a similar type of thing, we weren't watching them live in the house together. Like,
no,
they were trying to get drama from, not from reality TV personalities, but from talented, hardworking musical theater people who were desperate because they haven't been given the opportunities they deserve, which is what most musical theater people feel like, right? It's like, there are less than 10% of the people who audition for theater even like really get to work professionally as an actor. So like that's what I wanted to dive into, and I feel like we really did when it came down to just the 10 of us.
It got very real. So a quick background for anyone who is, you know, aware of what we're talking about but doesn't know the details. When Legally Blonde opened on Broadway in 2007, it, you know, it was doing fine. It did not do as well as I think they were hoping. And they were, Laura Bell Bundy was going to be closing out her contract after a little over a year into the run. And they wanted to cast a star to replace her, but every celebrity who came to see the show apparently was like, no, because the role of Elle Woods is a beast.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, a lack of honoring the show or anything like that. It was because all these celebrities would see the show. Like Hailey Duff could not do Elle Woods. Hailey Duff came in to do Amber in Hairspray and barely survived that. But, you know, you can't ask a celebrity who's never done 8 shows a week to come in and do probably like one of the most rigorous physical and vocal parts on Broadway since like Sweet Charity, where they're just on stage the entire time giving 10 out of 10 out of 10. And so they're like, okay, we really can't maintain ticket sales with a really talented but unknown Broadway actress. And so Amanda Lippitz, the producer, had a really great idea, which was to, let's do a reality show where we find the actress so America can fall in love with the person that we're going to cast and want to see her.
Yeah.
So we get someone who's talented, someone who's like trained for it, and people can see that she's worked hard for it, and she becomes a name because of the show. And so the whole series was sort of that. And it was rewatching it. And so the three judges were the book writer, Heather Hawk, casting director Bernie Telsey, and then castmate Paul Cannon. And then they would have people from the show come in and out to like, as like bonuses, I guess, like girls would do mini challenges and get a spa day with Orfei.
That stuff was truly crazy. That's the other thing that's so funny, is it's like, this is not a real prize, you guys.
No. Well, so it, what was interesting was, and again, we're going all over the place, so I apologize, but like, you could see the girls who kind of understood more about the process of being in a show and what it took to get into a show, because they would use their, some girls would use their like one-on-ones with cast members in a very professional way of like, you know, what are some tricks you have for like the scene or for the character? Like, what's something that trips you up in the show or things to look out for? And then other girls would be like, what's New York like? And it's like, that's not what you want to be asking Richard H. Blake right now. You want to ask him like, what's the key to this scene in Sirius? We're about to do this a million times.
Yeah.
And so that was very interesting. And they would like, watching it, I went, oh, this shows you, it's because it's a precursor to Drag Race, to RuPaul's Drag Race. And it really shows you how talented the producers of Drag Race are, because the challenges are just as over the top in Drag Race, but they know it is. And they use that not to sort of like manipulate the contestants, but to just sort of get them exhausted enough to let their guard down. They're not like trying to force drama. They're like, oh, we're giving you this challenge. Now you're exhausted. Go back into the workroom and do what you do. And then like the queens on Drag Race would create the drama. Whereas on Legally Blonde, it was like, we'll get to Questionnaire Gate in a second.
I mean, that is one of the worst. It's inexcusable.
It is really inexcusable.
What they did there, it was not cool.
We'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, as you said, it's these girls. First of all, many of them are really girls, like 18, 19, 20. And all they want is to do theater, and they're talented and they're hardworking, and they are so many of them have never been to New York. They don't understand like how cynical show business can be and how they're probably getting played by producers in front of the camera. So they're like editing to make them look bad. And it's like watching it, I was just like, this is really heartbreaking because these, even all these girls ones, are doing are just trying to do their part.
Yeah. It's really like, but that's also what makes it fun to watch, I think, is like these girls are heroes and you are rooting for all 10 of them the whole time because you see how like pretty messed up this is, like, because even like Lena Hall, who like I said had I think already done at least 3 Broadway shows at this point, when she was on the show, they edited her. She said on the reunion, there's a moment where she's like, she's crying to camera in a talking head and she's like, they're treating us like children, it's so unfair, I don't want to be talked to like I'm 2 years old. And they edit it to make it seem like she's talking about Bernie Telsey and Heather and Paul, the judges. And she's not. She's talking about the MTV producers who are not feeding them and not these reality shows. And they just cut it to look like she's saying, I mean, at that point, it's like, oh, the way you're portrayed is so completely out of your hands. And like the whole Cassie S of it all is like so crazy. I don't know if you got to this part in the reunion, but I just feel horrible for her because, I mean, the edit that she got is really messed up. And again, she was what, 19 years old? And she said that girls would follow her around in the mall. A girl dumped soda on her head. They would, they would corner. She got cornered in an H&M by 3 girls. And they were like, why are you mean to Bailey? Like, it's crazy.
Oh,
it's
my
really,
God.
Yeah, she was like harassed. And you know, Lauren talked a little bit about this on the reunion too, about like, Lauren said something that hit me really deep. And she was like, you know, comments that you guys made back then on the Facebook page, because again, this was like pre-YouTube really, but like the Facebook page for Elle Woods, like some of the stuff that you said to me when I was an 18-year-old on the internet is still stuff that rings in my head that I can't get rid of and I never will be able to. Like, you know, like I can love myself and I can work on myself, but you know, those things you said are in me now.
Yeah.
And I've internalized them. And there's, you know, it was such a fucked up time too, of like seeing how the internet is going to impact people. Yeah. And again, not reality stars, not Real Housewives going on here, like knowing the game that they're playing, but like people who are trying to make a career out of theater, which is, I don't know, it's all really crazy.
No, it's so crazy. And so this is another thing kind of pops in my head, the idea of how fake reality TV is. So first, like, I was wondering why it was like hitting me so hard watching it, because I said, you know, that reality TV is fake, and you know, it's not, I wasn't ever feeling anything but sympathy for the girls, and as you said, like rooting for them. And that was really kind of with kinder and more mature eyes, you can watch it and just, you know, see the craziness of it all and root for these girls to make it to the end. But I was like, why am I feeling this way? And yet like Bachelor just makes me infuriated, and like, and Survivor, you know, just makes me go, whatever. And it's because, I guess, as you said, with Real Housewives, those people know what they're signing up for. And, you know, Survivor and Bachelor, you're not aiming to get a career out of whatever it is you're doing. Like, you are manipulating a certain human experience for cameras, and you know that it's all about the drama. You know, Legally Blonde was a very real, very tangible goal that they all had, and you know, knowing that when they left, even if they didn't book L, they were still going to try to have careers afterwards. So they couldn't, you know, they didn't want to have a persona that no one wanted to work with. They didn't want to talk down to anybody else. They're like, we're all in this together. And so it's just really, it's really messed up watching how they edit those girls. And again, I cannot emphasize this enough. Girls, like 18,
girls,
19 year old girls.
Yeah.
Young, and like, girls.
And it's interesting because it's maybe one of the only reality TV shows ever that these girls didn't, it's so apparent that the top 10, all of them, the top 15, no one is there to be a reality TV star. Not a single one of them. There's not even a single moment in the show where you're like, oh, maybe, like, even on American Idol, where, like, the goal is to be a worldwide singer, you encounter a lot of people who are like, oh, you're here to get your 15 minutes of fame of, like, making a buzzworthy comment. None of these girls, even have an interest in being reality TV stars. The reality TV of it all is a byproduct of them thinking this is their only way to get their real goal, which is to be a Broadway star, which is to get on Broadway. So it's almost like, yeah, it's almost like you were like, unfortunately, have this add-on, but it's very fascinating to watch. It makes for really compelling television. Keep it positive.
Again, these girls are so young and they were so naive to and optimistic, thinking that this was going to be their chance. This was their hope. Even veterans like Lena Hall, and she's not the only one on that show who had Broadway credits. Emma Zacks had been on Broadway before that. A couple of them had been in national tours. So it's like, it's they were all just very new to reality TV, and MTV really just played the dirty, dirty game. And it was, and it's upsetting sometimes to watch, but I'm happy that they are past it now as much as they can be and are able to look back and sort of like reclaim their narrative.
Yeah, that's what was cool about doing the reunion, was I was like, oh, this like really, I mean, it's sad that this happens, but trauma like bonds people, and it really bonded them. Like it was cool to, yeah, it was cool to see that they, you know, they have a relationship like you would have if you had done a show with somebody before. It's like you can pick things up again 10 years later and chat about the inside jokes that you had when you were backstage or what have you. And that's definitely very cool.
So I stopped, I think it was about an hour and a half in, when the moment the finale was brought up. And I know that, you know, clearly, you know, things weren't going in chronological order because there was a whole hour afterwards, but Bailey talking about how part of what gave her nerves that day was that her ex-boyfriend showed up.
Yeah.
Like he had broken up with her right before she left, because he's like, I don't think I can wait for you. And she's like, I could be gone to, like, I could be gone after the first episode. You don't know that. And then she made it all the way, and he showed up to the theater, and she told Amanda, like blur him out, do whatever. I don't want to see him. And they did it, and that's all good. So knowing that that's where I stopped, and you know, the whatever happened after that, I want to ask you some questions from the Zoom reunion that you held with these icons.
Yes.
What are some of the biggest shockers for you, for things that like you learned listening to them?
The biggest shocker for me was that Legally Blonde on Broadway is Autumn's, to this day, only Broadway credit.
Crime.
It's a crime. I was like, oh, wow, this business is so crazy. Like, she has showcased how incredibly talented she is on this show for 10 episodes, and then she got to understudy Elle on Broadway, never went on, because Bailey never called out. And
get it,
so,
Bailey.
Yeah, work Bailey. And she, but she had such a, they all had such like really intelligent, beautiful things to say. And Autumn's was basically like, I wish I could go back and tell my younger self, like, it doesn't matter. Like, I have a wonderful life and I'm so happy. And I've gotten to do some amazing jobs and national tours and regional theater and, you know, just enjoy my life. Like, it having, you know, more than one Broadway credit does not have to mean as much as we put stake into it. Mm-hmm. The other thing that really shocked me was, I don't know if this was part of what Bailey was talking about with the finale, but at one point she basically has survivor's guilt. Like, it's really fascinating. She was like, saying to the rest of the girls, like, the best thing that could have happened to you guys was not winning this show. She was like, I feel so detached from all of you because I won. I felt this like wall between us because we were all working toward this goal together. And we were like, this family for a little while. And then I won and I felt like it completely separated me from the rest of you. And it was such an interesting take. And because, you know, now she's in South Carolina and she has a hair studio and she's not doing this anymore, which is also fascinating. It's like, oh, you can like, quote unquote, get the dream and then decide it's not for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, do you know the story of Barbara Harris, of Tony winning Oscar nominated Barbara Harris?
No.
Do you know who she
is? Yeah, I know who Barbara Harris is.
Okay,
yeah.
I was about to say, like, I don't know what kind of gay I'm about to talk to right now, because for me, Barbara Harris is a litmus test. Like, I don't think you can call yourself a cultured gay unless you understand who she is. Anywho.
I'm full theater nerd, so I know. Perfect. I'm with you. Yeah.
Also, like, there's no way you can be friends with Melanie Brooke and not know, like, Apple Tree and all that good stuff.
Correct.
Side note, you cowards do a production of Apple Tree starring Melanie Brooke, but that's beside the point. You fucking cowards. Anywho, I hope she listens to this episode. I really do. Barbara Harris was one of the most talented actresses for a while. She originated in Chicago. I think she's one of the founding members of Second City, and came to New York, did a couple of off-Broadway plays, took the theater scene by storm, and then came to Broadway and did musicals, and everybody's like, fuck, you sing? And and not only sings, like, sings well. Yeah. Won a Tony for The Apple Tree, left Broadway to go to Hollywood because she had stage fright, which is insane when you watch her perform. You're like, how can you have stage fright? You literally have more talent than anyone I've ever seen. Goes to Hollywood, does the movies Nashville, Freaky Friday. She was Oscar nominated for a movie she did with Dustin Hoffman. I forget the name because it's so long. It's like 20 words. It's like, funny thing happened on the way to the Forum times five. But anyway, she did a lot, and she had done TV and all that stuff, but she basically left the business by the late 80s because she did not enjoy it. She did not like performing anymore. She had stage fright. She didn't like the industry. Fun fact, there was that 80s concert of Follies at Lincoln Center that had like Barbara Cook, George Hearn, Manny Patinkin, and Barbara Harris was supposed to be Sally, and she backed out, and they were going to get Alan Alda to be Ben because he had done Apple Tree with her, and they were like, someone you know, a friend of yours, like, it'll be fine, there's no pressure, and she just like pulled up and said like, absolutely not. And so she spent the rest of her life, I think, in Arizona teaching. And it's crazy to think like someone could reach such major highs, like highs that so many people dream about and long for, and to get there and then to say no afterwards. It's insane. And yeah. I say insane, not like it's the wrong decision. I mean insane in terms of like, I don't know. It's something that you don't always expect, but it happens, and it takes you for a loop sometimes.
Yeah, it's always very shocking, but it's one of those things, it takes us for a loop because we are all so goal-oriented. Mm-hmm. And in some ways that's great, but in many ways it's like mentally not great. It's not great for your health to be so goal-oriented all the time and to think about these milestones, because the truth is that that is not what's gonna, you know, make you happy. Like, if she's happier in Arizona teaching, then that's great. Like, we all have to find those things that fuel us and that make us feel joy. And we are so taught to believe that success is about, you know, getting that Broadway show or whatever it is, winning that Tony, winning that Oscar. I was just listening to Brene Brown's podcast, and the Duplass brothers were on there. And one of them was like, I keep thinking in my head, like, I have to win an Oscar, I have to win an Oscar. But the really sad, deep, dark truth of it is I know once I do, I'm going to be so depressed. Mm-hmm. Like, because it's not about setting these goals for ourselves. It's never going to make you happy. It's never going to be enough. Mm. Never enough.
Fun fact, I've never seen The Greatest Showman.
Oh, you are probably fine.
I mean, I truly just don't desire to. But that's for another episode. You'll come back for a second episode and we'll talk about that. We'll get into that. No, you're right. So I actually have this book. It's actually a graphic novel, because I'm slightly a dum-dum who doesn't totally get the economy. And when Trump won the election, a friend of mine was like, the best thing you can do for yourself is to better understand how the economy works, or rather doesn't work, so you know who to vote for in the future and sort of what certain policies mean. So I bought this graphic novel called Economics, with an X at the end, not a CS. So you know it's for you. And it explains sort of the economic history of America. And part of our goal-oriented mentality, which really wasn't a thing until the 20th century, because our government really sold, quote-unquote, the American dream. in the 40s and 50s, this idea that, you know, you can have the family and the house in the suburbs and a good job, and if you work hard enough, you'll get the things. And that, and because America was recovering from World War II, and, you know, all these men were coming back from war, and babies were getting born, and jobs were starting to sprout up everywhere, that seemed tangible. But then, it wasn't long-lasting. And so the desire to be goal-oriented has stayed, but the goals have become more muddled and not unattainable, just the ways of getting them have proved to now have many roads, and those roads sometimes end and you have to restart, or you have to blow up the dream and start a new one. So it's, the mentality is still there for a lot of us, but it leaves more scars than glory.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's interesting that you bring that up, because going back to Search for Elle Woods, Emma Zacks actually has like a,
how dare you beautiful... bring this back to the topic, Tim?
Let's circle back to Emma Zacks. She has like truly one of the most beautiful, beautifully put sentiments about that, but dealing with, you know, show business. Because like we said, she had been in a few, I think three Broadway shows, mm-hmm. and now she teaches spin class in New York City. And she was just talking about how much happier she is now, mm-hmm. and how, I mean, this is not new information. This is similar to the Barbara Harris thing, but she just put it in a way that really honestly made me want to cry. I found it so effective. She just was like, you know, I was so afraid, like fear was driving me. And for me, like anxiety and like this Barbara Harris thing we were saying of being enough and doing enough drives us. And you have to take the time to stop and think, like, why am I doing this? Mm. Like, what is the point? And I think for her, she was like, my parents were successful Broadway actors. Like, this is what I saw growing up. This is what I thought I was supposed to do. And she was like, and now I get to perform several times a week doing something that I'm totally in control of and something I like better. Like, mm-hmm. I get to, you know, release endorphins and have fun and pick the music, and I'm not standing where other people are telling me to stand, doing what other people are telling me to do. And she's like, it's so freeing and so empowering. And yeah, I highly encourage anyone to just go to that. I think it's like the last 20 minutes of the mm-hmm. of the Zoom, but it was really just like beautifully said and so true.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like we all, especially, and I cannot stress this enough, how much social media plays into this. I'm very famous on this podcast for bemoaning social media while still having an Instagram account. But that's because I'm a very complex gay man, Tim Murray, mm-hmm. and I don't expect you to understand all the facets of me. But that's
impossible.
Couldn't possibly. I'm just so multifaceted. But I feel like sometimes we believe there's an audience out there that's pondering our next move, or, you know, our next step up or step down. And this idea of, I created this narrative for myself for this audience, and if I walk away, will I be considered a failure? Like, what will people think? And I mean, so many people just don't care because everyone thinks that they have an audience. So they're not really thinking about you. They're thinking about what you think of them. It's so...
Honestly, to get very real, that, I mean, Peter and I have had like a lot of really in-depth conversations. Like I said, there's no drama there. He's like a mm-hmm. brother to me. But he said a similar thing to me when he was like, I want to walk away from the podcast, was, you know, he said you are thinking of this as like a meal ticket for yourself, the Slumber Party podcast, like a way to get sponsors and pay your rent and mm-hmm. Be a calling card for you. And he was like, I don't want that. He was like, I just want to have fun and chit chat and have it just be about us kikiing, and I don't care if nobody listens. And I was like, that's so crazy to me, because I've never had that mindset. But I think he's right. I think it is all, it can't be about the goal. It can't be about the end result. It has to be about what you want it to be.
Yeah.
And that's what Emma Zacks was saying. And that's, yeah, I think that's.
And to keep it in sort of Legally Blonde format for a second, for some justice for Cassie S here for a minute.
Yeah.
Watching it, even like shady edits that they were trying to give her. And so Cassie S, if you haven't watched the show, she is a 19-year-old hopeful on the show, and they very much tried to make her the villain. They tried to kind of give her and Lena Hall the villain edits, but they really did Cassie S. dirty the most. And she's always wearing a bow. She's the image you can sort of think is like Dainty June, but like more like laser focused. And something that I've noticed in theater within the last like 10 to 15 years is that there's this sort of unspoken rule of it's cool to want it, but don't want it too much, because that's off-putting, especially with women, but in general. This idea of if you're too focused and you work too hard for it, like that's thirsty and nobody wants it. And I'm kind of, I have a foot in sort of both areas. So like when you were talking about you and Peter with your podcast, I understand both sides of the coin, because I'm sort of, I have mentality of both of like, I love to sit in Kiki. And I like when I record with John, it's just so much fun. And that's partly why I still do the podcast, but I also do it because like, I like having something to do. I like creating stuff. I like having stuff to put forward. I don't have to be 100 million followers on Instagram and Twitter. Like, honestly, that just seems super overwhelming, but I would like to know that there's at least one person out there that likes what I do. And I'm not just putting it out into the universe and there's nothing there. It's a little bit of column A, column B. I'm not saying that it has to give me a mansion, but I want to get to a world where I don't have to work five jobs in order to do my passion. I'd like my passion to be able to support me in addition to fulfill me. Let me say that again without a pause, because I really liked the way I worded that. I would like my passion to support me as well as fulfill me.
Yeah.
And that's real. And I don't think there's any shame in that. And I think that's where Cassie S. was coming from. And she was just very young and very hungry, and MTV could smell the blood in the water and they just went for it. So if you watch the show, guys, for the first time, just know that all Cassius's only crime is wanting it and working hard to try and get it. That's her only crime.
Yeah.
So if that's a crime, like, lock all of us up. Am I right?
Yeah, truly. Cause you're right. It can be both. Like, you can want that goal if it's what you want. If that is like what the Duplass brothers said, like, I want that Oscar, and then I know I'm going to be depressed. Because for him, it's probably about something else. It's about proving to everybody that he could get that Oscar, or what that Oscar would mean to get the next job. If you want it because you want it and it makes you feel good to reach for it, to work toward it, then that's the right answer.
Yeah.
And I think what the other thing Peter had said to me was like, no one's thinking about you. Like, if you stopped doing this podcast, like, it's not going to be as big of a deal to anyone as it is to you. Mm. And that's the truth. Like, no one, you are completely in charge of your own path and your own compass of like what you want to do. Mm. And nobody else, like RuPaul says, nobody else's opinions about me matter. Like, whatever he said. He says,
if they're not paying your bills, pay them bitches no mind.
Pay them bitches no mind. And there's another one that's like, what people think of me is none of my business. That's what it is. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I love that. I concur. And it's such a weird gray area, because performing in general, there is a sense of narcissism about it, because if you loved performing but didn't need an audience, like, you could, you know, in theory, perform in your bathroom every night before bed, you know, come home from your day job and do that. But there is a sense of narcissism with all of us who like to be in this business, where it's like, well, I don't necessarily know if the word need is appropriate, but like, there's something that you can't, indescribable, that's the right word, about having a reaction from someone, from something you do, applause, laughter, things like that. And I don't know, like, I don't think there's no shame in any of it. As long as, if what you do makes you happy and it doesn't harm others, like, I don't think there should be any kind of stigma to it. Whether it is, I want to be on Broadway and I'm working very hard towards it, or, you know, oh, I'm goofing off and I'm making stuff for myself. Like, it's, both are very valid. And I feel like you and I, Tim, are somewhere in that middle area where it's like, I like to goof off, but I also like when the things I goof off about reach other people.
You know? I want to give that validation. I just, bring it all the way back to the beginning, I was watching Broadway Bootleg at Once on Broadway a couple days ago, and I just love, I mean, it hit me so hard, that line that he says, and he's like, I don't want to play my music anymore, And she's like, why not? And he's like, because no one wants to listen. And she's like, I'm a person and I want to listen. And I was like, yeah, damn. It's not about the numbers of people. It's about, are you communicating something? Is this going to be special to someone? And by doing it, you're helping other people. You're benefiting other people.
Absolutely. You have no control over how many people relate to what you do or find out about what you do. It took me forever to ask guests, either on the pod or when I had my YouTube series, to like ask guests to help promote their episodes. I'm like, here's the thing. If you like wouldn't mind just like posting on your story or whatever. It took me forever to do that because I was like, oh, that's really shallow and that's really forceful and no one wants that. And I was like, you know what? No shame in it. Like, it's all it is just, it's 5 seconds of everyone's day to just sort of acknowledge that we did something together and to put it out there and people can listen to or not listen to it. But I don't know. It goes back to what we were saying about like wanting it, but not too much. And putting, as you said just now, like putting value in numbers and mass. And there's just something very, I don't know. My point got lost, but needless to say, I agree with you.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar.
So I feel like we cannot discuss Legally Blonde the musical, The Search for Elle Woods, without bringing up the toxic, nasty elephant in the room, which is Questionnaire Gate.
I mean, it truly just one of those things where you're like, oh, you were really trying to push them to their limit.
Yeah. And you can tell with the girls on the show when it happened, they were like, is this real life? Like,
yeah,
are people like, really trying to do this?
Kidding? Yeah. It was truly one of those like, all right, we're going to have you stand over a pit of lava moments and we might push you. Like, it was just like, it was pretty much as dark as they could go without asking, like, would you murder someone for this role? They, like, got as psychologically messed up as they possibly could.
Yeah. They weren't completely asking them to kill themselves, but they were like, if you had to kill yourself to get the role, would you do it? It was pretty crazy. Tim, do you want to explain to our listeners who maybe aren't as familiar with Questionnaire Gate what Questionnaire Gate was on the show? Like, what happened?
So it happens somewhere in the middle of the season, and these girls have already really been through the ringer. They've already made them get a line dropped on them by Nikki Snelson in an audition, and they made them, what we learned on the reunion was, cycle on those bikes. On the show, you see them do spin bikes and sing, and it's like ridiculous.
Yeah.
But then Lena Hall revealed on the reunion that they were cycling for 8 hours with like rare breaks, and they weren't feeding them, and that the producers are supposedly said, you know, implied that they hoped one of them would pass out.
Yeah.
So they've already been through this ringer,
and then they also did the dancing in like 20 degree weather on a cobblestone street.
Cobblestones, when one of them had bronchitis, Emma had bronchitis. She was like truly sick.
Yeah.
And they were out there in Brooklyn in the freezing cold.
Yeah.
So all of this has already happened. They've already been, you know, I'm sure doing extreme non-union shoots and like making them, you know, they're pushing them to the point of exhaustion. And then at the end of a really long rehearsal day, they bring in these questionnaire sheets that they slip under the door that one of the girls starts to read out loud and pass out, and they almost all immediately start sobbing because the questions are literally, one of the questions I will never forget was, who do you think is too heavy to play Elle Woods? Which is like, you don't do that to women in this industry. Like, don't do this to anybody, but like, to do that to young girls, to 18-year-old girls, or 28-year-old women in this industry that already is so psychotic. Like, one of my first roommates when I moved to New York is a really good friend of mine, and I'll never forget. She was a fantastic actress, but I'll never forget her being like, I don't want to do this anymore. Because I had a meeting with an agent after my showcase, and he was like, okay, so are you going to lose 20 or gain 40? Like, that's the only way that people in this business will see a woman on stage is like either you are a very large fat friend, and until like Bonnie Milligan, we rarely got those people as leads, even like getting to be their beautiful selves. So it's just, it was really messed up. So that was one question. And then another question was like something about, every single question was truly ruthless.
Yeah, like it was like pitting, because it was them, the producers of MTV, trying to pit them against each other, because they were being pretty copacetic the entire time, were being very supportive of each other. They weren't being very catty. And so the producers were like, no, none of this. We need in-house drama. So like there were questions like, who's the weakest singer? Who's the weakest dancer? Just as you said, like you don't do this to, you shouldn't do this to anyone ever. You should especially not do it to women, especially women of this age who are like going through the ringer to pursue their dreams. Like it's just, it's cruel. But there is a wonderful, positive Elle Woods-esque twist.
There sure is, thanks to a person we truly do not deserve to have on reality TV. But God, we're lucky we got her. Autumn takes the, she's much older than the other girls at the time, which I think was like a really helpful, honestly great TV, very good narrative to have someone who has been through this ringer already, like, you know, having that side of it that we root for, that's like, God, she's really been doing this for a long time, she deserves to go to Broadway. But also just thank God she was there to help these girls through this, like, truly, I mean, do you remember when you were 18? Like, it, when you're in college and people are dangling parts over you in a college show, you will do anything for it. Mm-hmm. Imagine you're that age and it's Broadway and you're on TV. It's just so crazy. So Autumn changes the questionnaire around and she makes them positive questions and just completely is like, all right, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it our way. Mm-hmm. And it's really a very empowering thing to see someone on reality TV who is so clearly being used as a pawn in these producers' narrative, change the narrative for themselves and for everyone.
Yeah, it's Autumn definitely changes the narrative. It is so, it's such a baller move, because they couldn't, on the reunion, they said like, they would not let us not answer the questions. Like we were trying to like just not do it at all. And the producer was like, you can't leave until you do. And so they twisted it around and like, we'll answer them in our form, which I thought was so fantastic.
Yeah. And how they bonded together to do that, because I mean, if even one of them had been like, I'll answer the questions, then they all would have been screwed. Then, you know, I mean, they were in a competition to get their dream role. Like, if one person had done that, the producers could have easily been like, well, that's obviously the person that's going to move on.
Yeah.
And instead, they all banded together and they're like, no, our moral fabric is more important than this show.
Yes, than your manufactured drama.
And it seems like such a small thing, right? When you think about, like, I don't know, the major fights that happen on Real Housewives, or like the high stakes that happen on Drag Race, or like making people like eat, you know, centipedes and stuff on Fear Factor. But honestly, as much reality TV as we've all watched, I think this is the craziest and most psychologically damaging thing I've ever seen on reality TV.
Yeah. I think they were trying to make it sort of like when RuPaul asks on Drag Race who should go home tonight and why. But even on that, like, most queens will answer like, based off of tonight's critiques, I would say so and so. Like, no one comes for anybody like personally, like 95% of the time on Drag Race.
No. And to talk and no one would ever ask whose body isn't right enough to do this is like such a messed up thing to put in there.
Going back to the Zoom reunion for a minute, were there any other surprises from your interactions with these 10 goddesses?
True goddesses. Autumn, Bailey, and Emma, and the Cassie thing was really crazy. Mm-hmm. The just hearing like, yeah, the way she was, and what Lauren said about social media was really impactful. I'm trying to think.
Anything about like the aftermath? Because something that was interesting for me with the show is that when it aired, there was some traction behind Bailey being cast. And I remember they sort of like finished out the summer doing pretty well, but then it really kind of dropped hard after that. And they closed like 6 weeks after the summer was over. And so I don't know what like the aftermath was for all of them in terms of whether they got a shot forward after it or sort of like kind of stopped there, or if it was a step back for some of them.
Oh yeah, that's an interesting question. We talked about that a little bit. I mean, Lena Hall straight up said on the podcast, or on the reunion, I'm sorry, that she changed her name because of the show. Mm. She was like, I didn't want people to associate me with what happened on the show. So that, I mean, I think that affected her pretty deeply. They pulled Autumn backstage, Jerry Mitchell, and I think Telsey and a couple other people, right after they announced Bailey winning. And they're like, mm-hmm. Hey, we just want you to know you did an amazing job, and we want to offer you a role in Legally Blonde on Broadway as well as the understudy. And Autumn said, she was like, this might sound ungrateful, but this is what I was feeling. I said, can I play Elle on tour instead? And they were like, no. Huh. And she was like, but for me, it was like, it's very exciting to make my Broadway debut. But when I thought in my heart about what I wanted to play Elle.
Yeah.
And I totally get that. I was like, yeah, I mean, you worked so hard toward this thing.
I think Elle by that point was cast on the tour though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't like a, you're not good enough. It's like the role, like that's already been filled.
Yeah. It's like, there's nothing we can do. But then, and it was Becky Goldsfig who is
so talented.
Amazing. And then Rhiannon got to play, Margot on tour.
And I saw her do that on tour.
Really?
Yeah.
I
think it was my freshman or sophomore year of college. They came to the Boston Opera House and, Courtney Wilson was, Serena, and she was so good. And I saw Rhiannon as Margot, and I was so blown away because I remember on the show Rhiannon, who made it to the final three or final four, I guess, because she and Lauren Zachrin got eliminated at the same time. She was sort of, the idea was like she had the personality and the bubbliness and the energy, but she didn't really have the voice. That was sort of like her quote unquote character arc. And so when I saw her the tour, I remember being so blown away by how good her vocals were. And then I had to remind myself, I'm like, oh, I only saw the vocals that they wanted me to see on the reality show. Like, I'm sure there's a take or two where she absolutely slayed it, but that didn't fit with her arc. And so they didn't use it.
Yeah. And funnily enough, when you watch the first episode, she's one of the only girls that they show singing almost all of So Much Better. And she sounds so good.
So good.
She like falters in the last note a little bit, but like it's, so that's, I feel like that was the producers being like, okay, we'll show this like last note and then this will be the edit she'll get.
Yeah.
But she's a great singer. And so she got to do that. And then Lauren, who's also in the top four, got to understudy Elle on tour. And then Becky Goldsfig broke her foot. And so Lauren ended up playing the role for like 6 weeks on tour.
Get it, Lauren.
Or more. And she is, I mean, that girl is a star.
What has the fan response been to the Zoom reunion?
It's been awesome. It's at like 27,000 views right now, I think, and people are loving it. I think they just are happy to, and people have been really kind in the comments, like, because I think that was another big thing the girls went on a long talk about, was like, we can't handle any more like negative comments. Like, you all need to realize when you write stuff online, it affects people. And so I think that was like a beautiful thing that they did, because now all the comments are really positive for the most part.
Good. That's wonderful. That's lovely to hear. And they all seem to be doing well these days, you think?
Yeah. It was very cool to see how they've all like grown into these like very mature people. A lot of them are moms now, and they had their kids come join the calls. Bailey's daughter is named Elle.
That made my ovaries swell.
I mean, truly.
Yes.
Truly.
What do you think you're going to do now with your Legally Blonde Elle Woods journey? Like, what's next for Tim now with all this information and these realizations?
The most recent thing I did was edit myself. I've been editing myself into the Drag Race season as girls that were cut for time.
Yes, so I did see some of that.
I edited myself into the first episode of Search for Elle Woods as in the reunion, Rachel Potter said there was a deep, dark internet rumor that there was another house and they didn't tape any of the girls in that house and they never made it to air. So mm-hmm. I edited myself into the first episode as those girls who didn't make it into the house. And now I'm done. I was obsessed with it. It was super fun. It was awesome. But I don't need to do anything more with it. I want to keep following the fun and, like I said, like not be goal oriented and not try to brand myself too much. I just want to do the next fun thing that comes to my mind in this quarantine.
So Search for Elle Woods has been put to bed for a while, only to be brought back out again when you want to watch it and feel that Elle Woods jantasy, if you will.
The jantasy.
So I feel like this is a good time as any to wrap things up. Anything you do want to plug that's maybe coming up for you in the future that you have going on now?
Yeah, I am doing this Slumber Party podcast, and I do it every week, also on Zoom. We go live on YouTube, so if you want to ask us questions. I interviewed Britta Filter recently and Trixie Mattel, and hopefully we'll get some more fun Drag Race girls and maybe even Search for Elle Woods girl or some other Broadway people.
Yes. So
that's been super fun. Check out my Patreon. I make comedy videos every single week. Mm-hmm. If you want to donate to that, I would love that. And yeah.
And where can people find the Zoom reunion on YouTube?
You can find all of my stuff at tmurray06. That's my YouTube channel. That's my Twitter. That's my Instagram.
And that's everything. It's T-I Murray, right?
Just T, letter T. And then Murray, M-U-R-R-A-Y 06.
Fantastic. So people can find all those things there. You can find me, y'all, on Instagram at Matt Koplik, K-O-P-L-I-K. I only take positive reinforcements on all of my posts. If you have anything negative to say, send it to me via DM so I can send you a video of me crying to your response and you can see the damage you've done.
Love it. You can say anything you want to me on any of my platforms and I will drag your ass for absolute filth if you try to come for me, and you will regret it.
Tim, I didn't expect to end this episode so aroused, but thank you. That was the most topish energy you've given me in the last hour. Thank you. Daddy. Tim, we finish every episode with a nice diva, usually Broadway, but we've been experimenting with some movie musical ladies. Who would you like to close us out today?
This is very basic of me, but like my one, my true, my always is Sutton Foster.
We have had her.
You had Sutton. You want someone you haven't had? Okay, I got it.
Okay.
I got it. Colleen Sexton.
Ah!
Lucy from the Jekyll and Hyde TV.
And she was, what's her face, in the Legally Blonde tour. She played Brooke Wyndham. I saw her as well.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yes. That's oh my God, amazing. Way to bring it back around. Yes,
wow.
Colleen Sexton. I will make that happen. I am so pleased with that.
She's incredible.
She's so great. So guys, thank you so much for listening. Once again, this is where I whore out the pod. Please rate us, give us 5 stars if you'd like, give us a nice little gay review, or just, you know, a 4-word review. I don't fucking care. The algorithm doesn't discriminate. And until next time, you know, just keep enjoying quarantine. This is Broadway Breakdown. Take us away, Colleen.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.